This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, people? Welcome back to Rebound and Safety. And it's the next episode of our diversity mini-series. Let's jump into the intro. I'll tell you some more about it. Let's go.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution and one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviours.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding safety, crushing a stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Blue.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Today is another episode of our diversity mini-series. Quick message from our sponsors, and then we're going to do the caveat, the disclaimer that comes with this mini-series, because it's a very sensitive space, and then we'll get into the amazing guest that we have on today. So, you know who our sponsor is now if you're a regular listener to the podcast, but ultimately it's good to keep talking about them because they're an amazing brand. They're an amazing company. I just love them. I just absolutely love them, particularly Teresa, the founder, the flag bearer, so to speak, of Paradigm. She's an absolute legend. I love the lady. And she's built an amazing company at Paradigm. So what are Paradigm? Paradigm are human organizational performance experts. They've also got a HSE subscription service, which is specifically what sponsors Rebranding Safety YouTube channel and podcast. The HSE subscription service is that solution to enable the company that they partner with, particularly small, medium-sized enterprise, to build that foundation of compliance. It's going to help you put worker safety at the core DNA of your organization. But ultimately, this isn't a compliance off-the-shelf system. This isn't the kind of thing you're going to need to declutter a few years down the line, or you're going to have going to be all old view, and now we've got to go over to new view. You know, this has got human organizational performance woven throughout of it. So this system is compliance with the future of capacity building and human error and all of that stuff kind of built into it. It's thought about that. So it's building that foundation, but it's building those foundations ready for the next step as well. So if you're a small, medium-sized enterprise and you're thinking, I really need to get better at my regulatory and industry compliance, then this is the solution for you. If you really want to utilize the expertise, the subject matter expertise of the workforce, then this is the service for you. If you want Paradigm to be your right hand, you can contact them in the phone number and email address below. And if you do go to their website, don't forget to check out the Learning Organization webinars, an outstanding resource. So without further ado, let's jump into the caveat, the disclaimer for the diversity mini-series. I put this in here because I'm a bit nervous about this mini-series. It is something I'm really passionate about, but ultimately it's a space that we're all learning. And it's a space that, you know, we're all completely changing from what we were back in the day. You know, when I was born and raised, I was so kind of, I wasn't what I want to be now, what I would like me to be now. You know, I was so sheltered in a way, you know, and no offense to anyone that's raised me. I appreciate the person that they've created. But ultimately, I was very sheltered. I've lived quite a sheltered life in my wee little county. And ultimately, that means that this is such a learning journey for me. And it's the same for many other people around the country and around the world. We're all learning how to change the way that we talk, to be more inclusive, to be more diverse. And that learning process is never easy. And that means sometimes we slip up. And that means sometimes we say things and we think, oh, I wouldn't have said that, you know, a year later or so on and so forth. And ultimately, it means that you, the listener, may be more mature in this journey than the guest is on today's show, or I am, for example. So I think it's really important that when you're listening to this, you remember that it's coming from a good place. Both myself, my guests, and all of the guests that we have on this mini-series are all just talking about their own experiences. They're all passionate about sharing their journey to help others. So if you need to feedback, we want you to feedback. But if you do want to feedback, then please do it from an empathetic and understanding position. So please share, please comment, please message, whatever you need to do to get this message out there, which is a really, really important message. But ultimately, let's do it in a nice way so that we can all help each other. Ultimately, thank you very much for listening to that disclaimer. It just makes me feel a little bit more comfortable because ultimately, I'm not perfect to this and I'm really passionate about it. And I don't want that to devalue what we're trying to do here. And the aim of this mini-series is to raise awareness for the lack of diversity within our profession and to encourage more diverse cultures, sexual preferences, genders, etc., into the profession, because it brings better ideas, it brings new ways of thinking, and we need that. So without further ado, let's get into today's episode of the Diversity mini-series with the amazing Anne Gardner-Ashton. Anne does some amazing work for women in safety. She's also a great safety professional with some amazing stories. So it's a mixed bag in today's conversation. We talk a lot about her career and just general interesting challenges that she's had. One in particular was put me in a really difficult place because I really wanted to talk about that, but ultimately had nothing to do with diversity. So we kind of had to bring it back and then talk about diversity. So I think there's a roll call out there to bring Anne back on the podcast so we can talk some more about her previous roles. But ultimately, let's get into today's episode. Anne, welcome to the podcast.
It's lovely to be here. Thanks for having me on.
No, thank you very much for coming on. We're going to have a chit chat today. It's about your career, actually. So this will be really easy for you. Really
simple.
You're going to talk about you. Couldn't have asked for an easier conversation, really.
Fabulous. I know all about it.
You're an expert.
Chosen specialised.
Because we're going to slot this in as part of this kind of wider diversity mini-series. So and you're obviously doing quite a bit of work in that space, or you've had it lumped on you from when we last spoke, which I'm sure we'll kind of come on to.
Lumped is not quite the word, I suppose. But yes, I've been steered in this direction.
Yeah.
By personality stronger than I.
Awesome. Do you want to kick off by just giving us a brief introduction to yourself, and then we'll just have a chit chat from there?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I am a long-term health and safety professional. I've been doing it for a million years, and graduated as an environmental health officer back in the mid-90s. So it's been quite a varied career. I think for all the jobs in health and safety, I've probably done just about all of them by now. Starting off with council work, doing environmental health enforcement stuff, then moving into a very brief spell as a consultant, followed on by a long stint with the Metropolitan Police, and then moving up to be a director of health and safety. And then subsequent to that, I left that last year and gone back to consultancy with a view for it not necessarily lasting long, but is probably turning into something that's going to be a self-employment wonderland. So that's where we are, in a potted history, I suppose. So the gamut, I think, of health and safety jobs. So I could probably answer anybody's career queries, I hope, by this stage.
I think it's interesting that you say you've had quite a diverse background of safety. Like, do you think that's helped? Because I've got quite a diverse background, like works in so many industries. But then in the safety profession, it's very common to someone to be like, I've worked in construction for my entire career, which is really common. And I've actually struggled when applying for jobs where they go, well, yeah, you did work in manufacturing, but you don't anymore. So we don't, you know, we kind of don't really like that. We want you to stay in manufacturing forever. But I actually think it's a benefit to have a bit of a diverse background. What's your...
I think so as well. No, I think so. And it's not necessarily, I mean, if you've got a one subject career, so let's say construction, but within that, there are quite a few jobs that you can do. And I suppose if you turned the spotlight round on my career, you could say, well, by and large, you've worked in sort of people related health and safety. So it's not been hugely technical. It's not been particularly specialist, been fairly generic right the way through, but you know, it's all based around people. Whereas in construction, I suppose you can work on building sites, you can work in the, you know, as a principal designer, or, you know, there's a diverse range of careers you can have within that microcosm. But I suppose, you know, you can still move through a career ladder in the same way that I've done, you know, and you can work in enforcement in construction in the same way that you can work as a group director in construction. It's just the different industries, I suppose, that bring the diversity to it, and the you know, you can look at things with a slightly different perspective, and you know, different people, different customer bases, etc. So it just brings a different viewpoint, I think.
I feel like it's not like one or the other, it's a bit of both. Like, you want someone who's, if you want to work in construction, you want someone in your team who's like a construction geek, don't you? Someone who's lived and breathed construction. You want that person, but you also want a person that, like yourself, had worked in somewhere really different, like the police force, for example, and brings some weird ideas that we'd have never thought of in construction. Do you know what I mean? And like, so I had this stuff when I've worked in healthcare and housing, and now working in a trade association for construction and manufacturing. And some of the stuff I'm bringing over is like, well, this is kind of what they did in housing, which I think might work here, actually. And we'd have never thought of that. Well, that's because you've never employed anyone from housing. And why would you? It's just coincidental that that's happened. That kind of cognitive diversity thing, that diversity of thought.
Yeah. And I think it takes quite quite an open-minded employer to be looking at different industries to draw your talent from. But of course, the higher up the chain you go, the less you need to be technically minded anyway. So, you know, as somebody that can look strategically at health and safety, you could, in theory, go into any industry in the world because the principles are exactly the same. Stuff that you'll be doing is exactly the same. But I would struggle to step into a role with, Mace, for example, one of the large house builders, because they, you know, seem to want you to have risen up through the ranks of that, so you've got an intrinsic understanding of it. But isn't once you got into that job, it would be a lot around strategic health and safety. How do you communicate with people? How do you engage people? How do you report to the board? It's, you know, the skills are very similar.
I hate to ask this kind of really cliche question, but I feel like, seeing as it's the diversity mini series, we kind of have to. And actually, I think I've not long ago spoke to Louise Hoskins, who I know you know quite well. I think she's got a very similar career background. I think she started around the similar time in
health. She did exactly the same degree. In fact, we worked whilst I was doing that mini slot as a consultant. We worked for the same company, and that's how I know. And then we sort of split off into different directions. And now she's a consultant, and suddenly I'm a consultant as well. So yes, I think we are separated at birth. And she's the strong person, one of the strong personalities that I was talking about earlier, that seems to have sort of guided me into a role that I don't suppose we'll not discuss later.
Yeah. So the question is actually very similar to what I asked Louise. What is it like? What was it like in local enforcement as a woman around those times? Like, I know it sounds like a really horrible cliche question, but the stories is good to hear.
Oh yeah, well, and not only a woman, but a very young and naive, probably fairly impressionable, straight in out of university. You know, inappropriate hairstyles and clothing choices and attitudes and all sorts. So, I mean, I was quite a young adult, if you know what I mean. So it felt really exciting, suddenly moving 200 and some miles away from home. You know, that was my big, that, you know, I flew the nest. As soon as I graduated, I went from the northwest of England down to Berkshire. And that was my big thing. But it never... You know, my growing up really didn't get further than that for a while. That was adulting for me. That was enough being an adult, thanks. So going into something like enforcement, where actually, you know, you have to have both reserves of resilience and also come across in an authentic, you know, but strong and authoritative manner, probably wasn't for me. And I stuck at it for about four years. Felt like 4 years, and then just thought, you know what, this is not me at all. And actually, looking back on it now, I still have the traits that made me not a good enforcement officer in those days. I don't feel comfortable just walking in and telling people what they should and shouldn't do. I'm much more of a collaborative, well, very feminine traits, which again we'll probably discuss later, but all the feminine traits exist within me to do health and safety, and none of the authoritarian traits.
That's interesting. I like that it's going to take me down a little rabbit hole, actually, because that's really interesting. I've not long spoke to Rosa Carrillo. I don't know if you know.
And I picked up on the podcast clip that you did.
So she is like a bit of a soft skill. She don't like calling them soft skills. She likes calling them relational skills, which, fair enough. I mean, there's more names for soft skills than there is for anything else, I think. But anyway, and she raised a really interesting point around them being typically feminine traits, those softer skills, empathy, you know, building relationships, listening, or good listening, active listening, whatever you want to call it. And all of those skills are typically feminine traits. And then I was in another podcast with the kind of quarterly co-host thing we're doing with the, he was the, oh, bloody hell, what was it? The CEO of the British Frozen Food Federation. That just rolls off the tongue. And I said the same to him, like, typically they're kind of feminine traits. And we ended up going down this conversation that he was kind of like, not sure. Like, I think that men can get these. And I said, no, definitely. I think they can, but they probably come a lot easier to women, I think, maybe. I mean, I'm not a biologist, neurologist or whatever, so I don't really know, but they are inherently traditional female traits, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so. And there's enough research backing it up, I think, that that people in the HR world have done to say that, you know, it doesn't, nothing's binary, is it? And you know, people cross over with their traits. So, but I think when we're talking about how things are progressing, certainly in the health and safety world, it does feel a little bit like the rule-based safety is taking a back seat, and people, you know, now have to look at how messages are being received as well as how they're delivered. And that's where the fundamental changes are coming in, I think, whether you call it safety differently or safety two or people centered, whatever you call it. And I'm sure people call things a lot of name sometimes, seems to be a bit of a bun fight about it. But that's essentially what it's broken down to, isn't it? You've got a message to deliver. It's often unwelcome. It's often received with boredom and yawning and or negatively. So if you're going to make a success of this, you've got to look at it from the other side. And that's where the empathy and the listening and the collaborating and the understanding and the cocking the head to one side and, you know, looking really sympathetically at somebody comes in.
So how is that kind of, so I do think there's a side of nurture to it as well, because like I was raised by women, like Mowgli was raised by animals. I was raised by my mother and grandma. And I think I'm inherited, you know, the more softer side, safety too, whatever you call it, is it sings to me, like it really clicks with me. The rules stuff, it just never sat well with me. Like, you know what you said when you were in enforcement, that you're like, no, this doesn't work. I was exactly the same. Like, it just didn't, there was just something that didn't work with me inside. So do you think, you know, it's just worth saying that just because you're a man doesn't mean you can't have those traits. But how did that kind of, I was interested in those two worlds you said when you were in coming back into your story and enforcement, young, kind of sound like maybe a bit of a rebel with the hair and the like
pride,
and then the softer, empathetic, but were they kind of, and then being asked to be a kind of rule based role, those kind of worlds kind of colliding a little bit at that point, and 4 years and you moved on. Was there a specific point there that made you feel like that, or was it just natural over time? You were like, this is just not working for me.
Yeah, I think so. I was giving too many people the benefit of the doubt and trying to, I mean, yeah, I suppose it's been a long time since I was an environmental health officer, and things may well have changed now to be a lot more collaborative. But you had a, back in the day, you had a list of premises that you had to go and inspect every year. You go in, you try and catch them doing something that they shouldn't be doing so that you can tell them off and write them a really big report and serve notice on them or something like that. But there was no opportunity to sort of really sit down and chat with them about how you can do things better, unless they were going to pay for a training course. So it was the opportunities to do that discussion, you know, meeting in the middle, you know, getting to understand why they did what they did, just wasn't there. Yeah. And I suspect probably now it's a little bit more collaborative with business because it's opened up a little bit. But back in those days, it was just, you know, I just felt my soul being sucked out of me every time I went in there. And, you know, it depends, with some places were absolutely lovely, and I actually made quite good friends with some of the, which equally made it really difficult. So again, you know, sort of bleed into the wrong kind of relationship with somebody. which they may or may not have taken advantage of that, I couldn't possibly say. And I certainly won't be saying which restaurants they were.
But they are currently my favourite restaurants.
I always eat from there. So it's, and I think, you know, at that stage I was like, well, this is my job. This is a job that I have to do, and I've got to try and do it to the best of my ability. And then sort of 18 months out from leaving, I was thinking, I can't do this again. I can't go through this round of, you know, going to see the same people, telling them the same thing all the time, them not doing it, and, you know, all of the heartache that comes with that. So, yeah. And then that sort of moved into, well, consultancy is good because then you just tell them what to do and then you can go. You don't have to worry about whether they're doing it or not. And then again, that was a bit, well, that ended up being too formulaic in a way. So although you weren't, you know, although you weren't going into businesses to tell them what to do all the time, at least with a business, you had some variety in there and you had a bit of, you know, you different personalities and so on. But in my first stint as a consultant, it was very routine-y and very formulaic. And it just so happened that the job at the Met was advertised. And it's the sort of job that you can't look away from. Well, it was for me anyway. And so, yes, it didn't last very long.
Interesting. I want to talk about the Met, and I will in a minute. But it's interesting that actually the way you've kind of come across this your challenge, sort of, we've spoke to a few people and a few women in this mini series so far, and a couple of them, you know, like just Crystal comes to mind, where she, you know, she had a real challenge actually just with the relationships with men and how they treated her. But yours is really interesting because it's more about your inherent traits as a woman that were conflicting with the job, not the interactions you were having with people, which is fascinating. Why do you think you didn't just go, do you know what, safety's not for me? What made you stay with safety? Which I'm curious, because I think if there's that much of a clash, and then you went in consultancy and were like, oh God, it's the same. And maybe it was the timing of the Met job coming up. But I think a lot of people at that point might have gone, this career choice is not right for me.
Possibly. Yeah, possibly it was. But I've never had a problem getting on with other people, male or female. And possibly, I don't know, maybe unusually, I've never felt a sting of discrimination when I've been either applied. It may have been there and I'm just really naive and blind to it, but I've never felt as if, you know, somebody hasn't treated me in accordance, you know, with respect or whatever, because I'm female, maybe because I'm young, maybe because I've got a stupid hairdo and wearing, you know, ridiculous boots or whatever, but not because I'm female inherently. So it's very much about, you know, it's perhaps quite self-aware, I suppose, to realise that, you know, when you're looking at your career, to pick out the bits that are good about it and identify the bits that are bad and decide that you don't want to do those bits. It's not about interpersonal issues at all. It's just about whether I as a person am suited to that particular role. But I had knowledge and I had the interest, I wouldn't have called it a passion, and I still wouldn't actually, but I certainly had the interest and the knowledge and the spark to be able to see health and safety as a problem solving exercise. And that's where it's not the technical bit that interests me either. It's the problem solving. It's the getting to grips with people's issues, working with them to find a way around it, and then, you know, getting to a mutually satisfactory conclusion. And that's what it's always been about. And that's why that first stint of consultancy, not actually really very appealing, because you were just providing them with a formula risk assessment or a formula report that you then sent them away with, and you didn't work with them to try and fix it. Which, you know, the second half of my career, I suppose, to date has been all about that.
Do you think that maybe that was of its time, like maybe of that time, that's the kind of safety that people wanted then, but now it's a bit more problem solving with a little bit of the formula stuff kind of tagging on? But that's interesting. So it was that problem solving spark that you just kind of were able to focus on and say, no, I still believe that's there, even though the traits and are clashing at the moment, but I still love that, which kind of kept you in the career. That's interesting. You said something there, which is interesting, about the youth side of it and
which I think is fascinating. You mentioned the youth, your hair and your boots. So that's interesting. And I think it's interesting for me because I was started in safety with no university, no nothing, just literally fell into it like most people do, but at quite a young age. So I was 20. Yeah. Was I 20? I was at 20, 21-ish. And I actually found the biggest challenge for me was just the assumption that I don't know what I'm talking about because of the youth. You know, there's an assumption that young people are stupid and they don't really know, you know, they need to get some years on them and stuff like that. Or as well as just talking to a person before you came on about if you're maybe trying to, especially now, as you, some of the new view stuff might be seen as a bit progressive, if you're young and trying to push this more progressive, I say in quotations, view of safety, they just kind of maybe make an assumption that you're just young, far left and woke, and that's it. Do you know what I mean? And I felt, maybe that's what you're saying, maybe it wasn't, but I could definitely relate to that one liner you said there about maybe the youth side of it. I felt that for sure. I think that's something we maybe still struggle with as well. I think Louise said the same.
Yeah. And I think it's possibly the job that you go into, you know, as your first health and safety role that potentially defines whether you're too young for it or not. So for Louise and I, going into an environmental health role where you're expected to, you basically stand up in front of a magistrate or a judge and be an expert witness.
Wow.
At the age of 22.
Jeez, yeah, that's massive. Yeah,
and I'd just done 4 years of university. Quite frankly, I knew jack shit. But you know, and in, within my first week, it could have been me stood up giving evidence against somebody. And so I think, you know, in that role, you know, seasoned business owners probably had the right to look at me and think, what the hell do you know? Yeah. Wet behind the ears, stupid boots. and I, you know, with the, I said to my niece, who's only a little bit younger than me, has gone into the same career choice. And I said to her really early on that actually most jobs, especially when you're younger, is just an acting job. It's not an anything job, it's just an acting job. So you've got to be able to put on not necessarily a game face, but certainly your work face, and not let your true personality when you're very young come through. And I think, you know, however non, well, it's not PC, is it? But however much you'd like to think, well, people want to be authentic and they, you know, want to bring their whole selves to work and all of that kind of thing. Well, actually, I think there are certain circumstances where you can't do that and maybe you shouldn't do that. You should adopt the persona of the health and safety professional that you want to project. Now I wouldn't do it. Now I'd tell them to bugger off. You get what you're given.
Because now you're kind of in a position where you can do that, aren't you? But when you're young, you can't.
No, I think so, because I've earned my stripes in a way. So I think you've got to pretend you've got stripes early doors, and then you actually earn them, and then you can display them.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I feel when you first said it, I was like, I'm not sure I agree with that, because of that point, you know, it's a bit woke to be authentic and stuff like that, which is, like I say, it always kind of sings to me. But yeah, now you say it, and I think back to me in my first job, second job, maybe even third job in safety, was like, yeah, the version of James that they got was different to the normal version of James, because I hadn't earned my stripes to be what I needed. And as well, I needed the money. Do you know what I mean? I needed the job. I needed the money. And I talk about this a lot of time with like people that are, listen to this podcast or part of Project Millennium or whatever, and they're kind of a bit frustrated or they're trying to do something. And sometimes I think maybe you get to a point where you have to make the decision. It's either authentic you, but somewhere else, or to use your words, the actor version of you where you are now. You just have to make that decision. But sometimes you're just not right, are you, for that company, and they're not right for you.
No, and I think you've got to be quite brave to be able to recognise that. And I think people in health and safety can spend whole careers not finding that authentic self, and probably, you know, spend a lifetime in a job that doesn't really suit them, but they're there for either the money or for comfort, or, you know, because they don't recognize it in themselves to break away and do something else. Yeah. So, you know, from my perspective, after those two early jobs, it was clear that, you know, I've had enough of acting it out, and wanted to start doing something that was much more me.
Yeah. Which brings us nicely onto the Met. So talk to me about the Met. What was your role within the police force then?
I started as a senior safety advisor. And then by the time I left 12 years later as the head of operational safety and health, which, as you might imagine, is no small job, really. But it's very interesting. You know, talk about microclimates of the weather. Well, the Met Police, and probably any police service, is a sort of microcosm all of its own, and a way of doing things all of its own. But for a health and safety professional, it's fascinating because, of course, like normal health and safety jobs, you're protecting people from risk the whole time. You're pulling them away from it. You're shielding them from it. With the police and other emergency services, straight in there. Yeah. So you've got to manage it much more pragmatically, which is where this whole problem-solving thing comes in. We've got a problem. We've got to chase a baddie down a railway track. How are we going to do that? Well, let's work out, you know, what needs to happen to allow that to take place. So, you know, for every... There was a lot of mundane stuff, don't get me wrong, but for all of the exciting stuff, there was a real brain challenge and a real stimulation to, you know, this has to be done. It's called the policing imperative. It has to happen. Does it pass the Daily Mail test or not? Well, if it doesn't, then it has to be done. And so you've got to find a way around and work very, very collaboratively with some of the senior officers who are fixed on the goal. Yeah. And not so much interested in, not interested, I suppose that's the wrong word, but are leaving the detail of how it gets done to somebody else. Absolutely fascinating. And from a professional point of view, opened up so many different worlds of doing health and safety, talking about health and safety, you know, experiencing some of the worst stuff in the world, and, you know, coming out of it the other side thinking, oh my goodness, what on earth have I learned there? And taking years to process it in some respects. It's a tough environment to work in because it has a certain way of doing things. You've got to be quite tenacious. You've got to understand who to speak to, which is not necessarily the most senior person. You think you're influencing, at that level, you've got to go in at staff officer level, which could be constable, sergeant, you know, somebody that you wouldn't talk to about strategic stuff, but there is the path through to you.
Leading up,
chief superintendent, your commander, whatever. So all of finding all of that out, it's a very steep learning curve. And then, of course, every 5 years you have a change at the top. And so everything that you've worked for the last 5 years, you've been putting in place, you've been shifting, well, really nudging and inching things forward a little bit. And then somebody new comes in, like, don't want it done like that.
Gone.
Want it done like, you know. So 12 years was about as much. I think that was either two or three cycles of commissioner. And I thought, I know, I can't do it all again. I just can't go back to square one all over again. That was on the strategic side.
You must have some resolve and resilience, because I worked in the NHS for only a couple of years, and we obviously went through the same thing. Every 5 years, new government, new Department of Health, and a new vision. And even if it was Tory stayed in again, it was still a different prime minister or a different, there was something different, whether it was an approach, and the NHS was always at the top, the same as what the police force is. It was a very powerful thing for them to talk about. And it was just like, oh, okay, that's what we're doing this year, is it? So everything I've just done is down the shitter, and we're not talking about that anymore. It's, so you must have some resilience too, because I was like 3 years, two and a bit years in, business redesign. I'm like, you know what? Nah, this is not for me. I'm off.
I think it's, you know, in some ways it's the people that you're dealing with though, because you do work with the people in the police who are interested in health and safety. So the health and safety department was a central team, and you work with one or two individuals in each business unit, whatever it is, who have an interest in health and safety, and they're your primary point of call, and they can actually become, you know, a really solid working relationship and somebody that you turn to try and get things done. So it's as much about the people and the personalities that you're working with as much as it is about the structures and the, you know, and the grind of it all. Because actually, you know, when you, what we were trying to do is move things forward strategically, but it's a huge, great big tanker to turn around. And the culture just doesn't feel like it was necessarily ready to push on strategically. But you've got to do what you can, because, you know, the world is expecting health and safety to be done differently. So you've got to try and keep just trying to poke it forward a little bit. But the underlying operational policing, health and safety stuff remained the same the whole time. And your job is to try and keep officers safe and get them home at the end of the day, despite their best efforts in some cases to do the opposite. So
would you have still been quite young when you went into the Met?
I was 29.
Wow.
I think.
So that's a massive job to take on at a relatively young age, still, really, 29.
Yeah.
Quite intimidating, yeah, I'd imagine.
It was. And dealing with the more senior people was quite intimidating. But again, you know, it's half game face, half authenticity by that stage. You know, there's a transition, like a lot of other things are. So sometimes you have to be prepared to dress up, put your big girl pants on and go in and do what it is that you need to do. And, you know, imposter syndrome would say it's all pretend anyway. I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm just talking a good game. But, you know, by and large, we were okay. It's not that they didn't want to do it. It's just that they wanted something really pragmatic. They didn't want their work to be interfered with by unnecessary bureaucracy and red tape and restrictions, which is exciting to try and work around.
Would that have been the perception? Would they have had that perception of that's what you're going to do before you're in the room? Did that exist, that kind of pre-existing perception of what you're going to do?
Yeah.
Did you have to kind of fight that? I mean,
yeah, I would say so. There was the health and safety team has existed for a long time, and I think it had been very rule-based, but very, you know, this is what you're going to do. This is what the law says that you have to do. So this is what you're going to do. And that didn't, and never lands well, does it? And it didn't land well with the police, senior police officers in particular. So there was a certain amount of butting up against, you know, two worlds colliding, I guess. But by the time I came in, you felt like that there was a bit of a softening of the approach and a let's see how we can make this work. And make sure everybody stays safe. But it's a good grounding. I suppose what we tried to do was just chip away at the foundations of it to make sure that it was safety is something that you think about as you go out and you do your job. It may not be the fundamental thing. The fundamental thing is catching the baddies, but it's a consideration that should be inherent in every decision that you make. And it does, you know, it pays dividends in the end, because you can sense it, you know, either, you know, you get fewer accidents perhaps, or you just hear people talking in a slightly different language.
Yeah, that's interesting. Something you touched on there that I'm going to ask you, like a completely left of field question that you alluded to there. What's your opinion of the kind of debates around safety first? And as you just kind of said, you know, safety maybe not our first priority. Our first priority is catching the baddies, so to speak. And in the police officer's head, you know, they're quite, I mean, my cousin-in-law, I think, if that's a thing. She's part of the armed response team in Luton. So, you know, and I love chatting with her, and unfortunately don't get to see her that much anymore, but you know, over a pint or something, a chat with her is just mind blowing, because the way she thinks and what she does is she's risk assessing dynamically in the moment straight away, where she's just like, I'm off, and it's all on her in her head, and she's doing her job, or she's deciding to do something or not to do something, which is a risk assessment. But safety is not really her first priority, because if it was, she wouldn't be able to do what she had to do. And I think that applies to probably the entire police force, really, doesn't it?
And any organisation. I mean, it's only fairly recently, to my knowledge, been acknowledged that anybody that says safety is their first priority is probably lying.
Yeah.
You know, that might be aspirational, but, you know, you've got a whole load of competing priorities, haven't you? And safety is one of them, but it's no more or less important than shareholder dividend or profit or whatever it is to an organisation. Otherwise it wouldn't exist. Yeah. So it's, you know, I think we have to acknowledge that it's got to be blended into the suite of priorities. And the, as you say, the police is a prime example of that. If you asked any emergency service, it would be exactly the same. Yeah. And like you say, I mean, the more exciting the police officer role, the more they consider safety as the fundamental part of their dynamic approach to an operation. It's when you get to the more routine policing, I think it's, you know, quite well, I've been out of it for 6 years or so I couldn't possibly say but we certainly found that the firearms units, the counter-terrorism units, they call them CBRN, the chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear.
Wow.
Team. I know, they're very exciting. They knew all about safety, funnily enough.
Yeah.
And that was, but they were able to plan to a certain extent, build it into their tactics, as well as their, as well as the operational side of things. They had a little bit of time to factor it in, but yeah.
Oh, what a fascinating job. Like, if we could probably just do a whole podcast on your career in the Met, if I'm honest.
Honestly, it really is. It really is. And it taught me so much about, you know, understanding the different ways in which safety and post-incident safety, if you like. So more on the well-being side of things.
Yeah,
that's when I started to understand a lot more about, well, it's not just the pre-safety, it's also post-safety as well. So I was with the police when the 7/7 bombings happened. So the day after the bombs went off in the tubes, the safety team were down in the tunnels where the trains were still there and the disaster victim recovery people were still down there retrieving the victims. And we were doing air quality monitoring, which is so laughably mundane when you think about what everybody else was doing. But we were there making sure, you know, the tunnel dust levels were being read properly, or there was no asbestos, or, you know, stuff that's so prosaic now, it just makes me laugh. But those guys who were doing body retrieval, the guys who were working down, they wouldn't go home. You know, these were specialist officers. They would not go home. They slept in a church hall across the road from the tube station. They got their head down for a couple of hours and then they went back, slept on a kit bag, went back in. Wow. You know, did their job day in, day out. And it took, well, you probably know, it took absolutely ages to clear the site and get it moving, get it sterile again, if you like. And that's when you started to look at them and think, how have you managed this? Mm. How have you even slept? How do you process that and take it home to your family?
And I
couldn't do it. I mean, now acknowledging it, looking back on it, I had all sorts of problems after that because of the stuff that you see. I wasn't really prepared. I thought I was, you know, I wanted to be a forensic pathologist when I was younger. I wanted to cut dead bodies open. So I thought, well, this is me. This is, you know, I can really go down there and I can be use in a disaster scenario. But came away from it thinking, oh my goodness me, these are people my age, you know, going to work like I was on the tube. This could be me. And when you start to personalize it like that, you take it all away with you. And, you know, it starts to become very affecting. But so it's definite interest in well-being after that and how police officers cope with that sort of demanding role and come out the other side of it. Not all of them do, of course.
It's fascinating because, oh God, I'm so torn now because this is like, I want to go down this Met route because this is just fascinating. Because when I did my, this is like, I'm not very proud of this story, but it's a good story to a point. And when I did my NEBOSH General a very long time ago, I was very young, naive man with, or boy, with some very thick blinkers on, I'll say. And the whole notion of stress and well-being to me was just, you know, I was that kind of guy that was like, well, you just tell yourself not stressed. You know, I was that naive, you know, and I wasn't exposed to it. Like, I've never had anyone talk to me about that or anything. So I wasn't educated in that. So I was just like, well, just don't be stressed. Just be happy. It pains me to think that I was like that. But I was on my knee bus general, and I've always been comfortable to be able to say in a training room, you know, something I struggle with or anything. So I got into this training room and we ended up talking about stress. And I was just like, again, this cocky young man that was just like, I don't get this stress stuff. Like, how are we supposed to risk assess that? What are we supposed to do with that? Blah, blah, blah. And I was very lucky at the time, really, that in the room doing their knee bosh, I had like I can't remember the official titles, but it was like regional head of operations for Cambridgeshire Police Force. Excuse the dogs downstairs if you can hear them. And pretty much the exact same role or a similar role for the fire service for another county. And then like some British sugar people and some other stuff as well. And we all started this conversation, and some guy then went, oh, it's a load of crap anyway. And then this other guy from the police force, he said something which stuck with me my entire career and will for my entire life. He said, if you want to know what stress is, mate, he said, listen to this. I've got a guy at the minute who's doing a job of child abuse, and he's having to watch every single video. And the room went silent. And one of the victims is two little blonde girls, and he's got two little blonde girls. He said, how the f- are you going to risk assess that? He said, that's what stress is, mate. And Jesus Christ, I felt this big. I felt so just, but in hindsight, I'm so glad he said it, because and I'm so glad I was comfortable to kind of voice my naivety in a way, because I got to hear what he said and my mind was blown. And, you know, so I can kind of, to a point, empathize just from that story of the challenges that you must have had with the team to be able to try and look after them. And you must have been coming up against that same battle in trying to, I don't know if you've watched like Line of Duty, but like they had this guy who's in the room and talking about his mental health because he just shot someone or something. And he's given, you know, the actor, it's this scenario like he hasn't got time to be there. He's trying to save the world kind of thing. So that clash still just comes back again and again, I imagine. Or is it?
It does.
Yeah.
Well, the one thing that the police are really good at, the Met Police work, and you talk for them, obviously, was trauma counselling and counselling in general, for the big budget for counselling. And it was mandatory. So you went to a situation like 7/7 or, you know, equivalent, or there was a firearms incident, or, you know, you were in the child abuse command and you went for counselling. No questions asked. And what they were very, very well trained in police trauma in particular, and sort of getting to the root of. So there were a lot of, you can picture the scene, can't you? You know, I'm all right. And then, you know, years down the line, sometimes it caught up with them, and they were very good at recognizing and keeping tabs on people who had experienced something, even if they didn't talk at the time. That they were followed through, and it was made abundantly clear that, you know, this was open for the rest of their career, potentially, if they needed to come back and have it dealt with. But yeah, I mean, some of what they do is just horrific, absolutely horrific. And I only experienced it for a few days, and it affected me for the rest of my life. So, you know, some of the things that they go through, I don't quite know how they might. Well, they've presumably talked it out, which I never did, ironically. So.
What was that like when you had that 7/7 and you had to, or your team or whoever had to go, hang on a minute, we need to do some air monitoring because there could be loads of asbestos there. Like, and these people are just desperate to get in and save, you know, I could just imagine it, like the pressure that you, I assume it was your team that were saying that, like, were under, because these people are desperate to go in and save these people that were stuck under the rubble. And oh my God, that must have just been unbelievable to be able to just have that conversation. Like, what did that? I mean, feel free to say I don't want to talk about it, but you know, it's
No, it's fine. I mean, fortunately, the negotiations happened at a pay grade above me, and my my manager at the time was very he was very easy to talk to, and senior officers found him very easy to talk to, and he had a good relationship with them. So he was very clear really early on that we were going to be some of the first people down there, clearly not the first, because that's just ridiculous. Yeah. So we had to, and in common with a lot of safety, you have to compromise on some things. And the compromise was that you do the search and rescue. In fact, the fire brigade actually did a lot of the search and rescue, do that bit first. They have all their breathing apparatus and they go in and do that stuff. But at some point, really, really quite soon after that, we accompany you down there. All right. So your exposure, your unknown exposure is as limited as possible. Because, of course, with the tube system, as you probably know, when you stop the trains, the ventilation stops as well. So you've got very rapidly encroaching rancid air, which is tunnel dusty and asbestos from the brakes. And there's
Jesus. I didn't even think of that.
Well, some of the older new ones don't have it anymore, but the older trains that were running at the time do have asbestos plates.
Jeez.
Some of which were blown apart. There's tilt switches, or I can't remember the names of them now, but there was switches in the doors that allow them to go forward and backward that had some pretty potent chemicals in, which are enshrined in glass, which of course doesn't survive bombs very well. And so there was all that to consider as well. Plus, you know, you can't avoid it, biological hazards that were there too, plus the potential for any unexploded ordnance. There were so many unknowns going down there that, you know, we couldn't have possibly done them all. We had to trust that those police officers had the underlying dynamic risk assessment knowledge to go in there and assess a situation before they got involved with it. But they don't have the specialist kit to do air quality monitoring. So there we were buzzing away in the background, taking readings and taking them back upstairs. But it was like the fires of hell. It really was. So I did, mostly mine were the subsurface trains at Edgware Road and Aldgate. A couple of my colleagues did the Russell Square one, wasn't it? And it was deepest line in London, down on the Piccadilly line, and it was baking, absolutely baking. They lost about 2 stone. In fact, most of the police officers down there lost so much weight. They had to do in really quick rotation, come up and down if they could, because it was just so hot. Nothing, no air movement at all. So in the air, because the problem, going into a lot of this, I dare say you'll cut most of this out, but because they couldn't have ventilation in there, and because they were all basically, you know, dehydrating and, you know, passing out from the heat, they had to find a way in which they could have fans running without it disturbing the forensic evidence that was all around. So they had to set up some sort of elaborate sheeting exercise.
Oh, really?
You know, allowed some air movement in, but stopped everything from escaping. So it's huge, great sheets all around the tunnels to sheet it all in like an evidence tent. And they managed to get some ventilation in there eventually.
So if I imagine this correctly, my imagination of any police activity is all coming from line of duty. So I'm imagining these forensic people in their full on forensic getup, so none of their stuff contaminates the scene.
Mm-hmm.
A tent in underground, and I think it was summertime, like you say. Was it?
Yes.
Around, yeah,
July.
Summertime.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah, July. And so that's what I'm talking about: like shoe covers, the kind of overall things, the head, and then they're in that tent and they're underground. Jesus.
Plastic tent, no ventilation.
Oh my Lord.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable. I mean, you kind of know that's what happened, but then until you kind of think about it, like to your point where you go, hang on a minute, July, tent, overalls, underground, you know, Jesus. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I'm not being funny, but if you can imagine the additional input of bodies in there,
yeah,
you know, and how rapidly they may be affected by that kind of heat and lack of ventilation as well. So it all adds up to being, you know, if they are not true heroes, without their capes, I don't know what a hero is.
Exactly.
Really.
Yeah. Are they just?
And meanwhile, of course, upstairs, you've got all this from the mayor. We must reopen. We must reopen. We must reopen. We must get the tubes working again. We must do this. We must do that. London can't come to a standstill. You know, the economy has to keep moving. So it's multi-layered, the kind of pressure that you end up being under. And it's from the senior officers are getting it from
everywhere.
Powers that be.
Yeah.
The officers underground are working in the most hellish conditions you could possibly imagine. And so, you know, if you told me anybody had gone out of those situations unaffected, I'd be calling you a liar.
Yeah. And the interrelationships must have been interesting as well, or challenging is probably the better word. Like, there must have been, you know, I'm just thinking of like the thing you mentioned about the door frames and the chemicals and the asbestos, like that information that must have been with the travel for London, the TfL or whatever they're called, Transport for London. So you must have had to have like a good interrelationship with them, say, where's this information? We need this. Like, it's like trying to do construction planning, talking to all these different people, but in the pressure of we need it yesterday kind of thing, which, yeah. You know, I've worked in construction. It's a nightmare when you've got a 4-year project, let alone a 30-second project, which is probably what you had.
Well, I mean, you know, obviously they knew about it really quickly because it happened on their network. And so they shut everything down, all of, you know, all the electricity had to go down straight away. And so everybody had to like cart in these great big temporary lights because there's no lights down there. So it's like, you know, people hefting really heavy equipment down into, you know, however many stairs it takes to get down to Russell Square in particular. But they were getting out the schematics, all the, you know, all the tube tunnels and where they offshoot to, and, you know, where's the nearest point that you can pump some power out of, and, you know, all of that kind of thing. Plus, the construction of those particular tube trains, are they old stock, are they new stock, are they whatever? So everything had to be checked so that those dynamic risk assessments could take place, because they can't take place in a vacuum, can they? You've got to have some sort of information to work with. So all of that had to happen really quickly as well. And they were really, really good information providers. So for us going down there running some buzzing machines, they were saying, well, you're likely to find this here, but actually, you know, if you're talking about Aldgate and Edgware Road, there's a lot of lines coming in at once. So the tunnels are really quite big, and also they're semi-open to the air as well. So you could take all of that into account when you're trying to look at build-up of gases or dusts or whatever. You've got a certain leeway in that, which they didn't have at Russell Square, which was enclosed about 500 yards or so between stations. In fact, it was directly between stations, I think. So it's a hefty walk with a lot of floodlights and great big cases of equipment.
Do you know what? I didn't even think of that. In my head, I'm just thinking, oh my God, they've got to come down the stairs down to the station. But it's not, is it? It's down to the station along the tube or down the service hatch. It wasn't at a station. It was, oh my God. So, I don't even have any words. Like, I'm not very often I'm lost for words, but Jesus.
Those invisible jobs. But yeah, they do. I went on to, there was about three or four of us that were the health and safety advisors for one of the only national cohorts of police that there were at that stage. There's a few more now, but it was the disaster victim identification cohort. So effectively they were set up, mobilised if there was a disaster abroad, to not only offer assistance, but also to sort of try and identify and repatriate British victims. So, you know, for example, a tsunami, we had a cohort went out there, and that was sort of started to be the formation of when it was formalised.
Kind of like the Tunisia thing and stuff like that.
Yeah, all of that. So wherever there's not necessarily a British national contingent in there, because we do offer service, they do offer services to help out, you know, to developing countries or whatever with some of their stuff. But it really, you know, there's probably, I don't know, maybe 7, 8, 9, 10 countries where they have a very mature cohort of people that can go out and do what they need to do. And the disaster, the victim identification bit, for me was key. Coming back to forensic pathology, of course, I finally got my work with dead bodies in the end. Not quite the way in which I was expecting it to be.
Yeah.
So the body recovery and the victim identification, absolutely fascinating. Podcast all by itself, really fascinating stuff.
At this rate, we'll have to get you back on like 5 or 6 times, if I'm honest. It's fascinating.
Waffling.
It's not waffle at all. It's unbelievable. Like, I didn't even know I had in the back of my head, oh yeah, he worked in the Met, but like not during that time. That's unbelievable. And they're just, God, what an experience to have gone through. You must find every other safety job now just unbelievably mundane. Like,
yes, thank goodness. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, yeah, you can do the dynamic stuff for a while, but you know, probably a lot of police officers will tell you that it's, you know, it can be a short life, not literally, but it would be short shelf life on some of this. And in fact, you know, for things like the child abuse command, you get rotated. You can only do 2 years or whatever it is. And then you have to move out and do something else, because it would just, I don't know whether it would inure you to it or, you know, I don't know. But
it would have some damage, wouldn't it, on you mentally? It really would. Yeah,
must really do, surely. But yeah, I mean, it was an exciting time, if you want to call it that.
In quotations, yeah, I get what you mean.
Yeah, but there was a lot going on, and there was loads of learning from it as well. The disaster victim identification bit, or the formalising, because it ended up being a postgraduate diploma course as well, just to learn to be a disaster victim cohort officer or staff member, as two or three of us were. So you had to go up to Dundee and do a course in human identification. So if you've got a drowning victim or something, how to remove clothing bit by bit, how to photograph it, how to evidence bag it, how to put it away, you know, catalogue it and all that sort of thing. And everything has to be done so carefully and so systematic. You don't want to lose any kind of evidence at all, whether that's a label or a tattoo or, you know, depending on what's happened to the person, it makes a real difference to the sort of identification you can get out of them. So if you have a drowning victim, for example, their hands often degloved. So where are you going to get the fingerprints from? Well, you might get them on the toes because they're probably wearing shoes. So, you know, you're looking for things in quite a dynamic way, I suppose, looking around a problem.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got, and all of these things, you've got to mark on sheets of paper that, you know, you've got, you have anti-mortem forms, which, it cut all this out if you want, but just for the sake of
this is gold. Yeah,
if you have if you have two types of disasters, really. You have an open disaster and you have a closed disaster. So if you have an open disaster, you imagine the tsunami where you don't know who's where at any one time. If you have an air crash, for example, you generally know who they were because they're on a manifest and whereabouts they were sitting, probably. Excuse me. So that sort of helps you right from the start. So if you report a loved one missing, this is why all these casualty lines come up. If you think somebody's been involved in, you know, ring this number, and they take a whole load of information and they put it onto a yellow anti-mortem form. So you've got to tell them if you've got tattoos, if what colour hair, you know, all that sort of business. And then if they grade it down to somebody that they think is very likely to have been affected by this particular disaster, they then go out and take hair samples, toothbrush samples, genetic DNA samples, whatever. And then so you have a yellow form for people who have reported missing, and then you have a pink form that you use in the mortuary. And the pink form is where you fill out all of the characteristics of the person that you've got on the bench. And that's absolutely everything that you could possibly, even down to, you know, really intimate details about somebody, because you know, so that might be, you know, well, this person's got Prince Albert, so you've got to go, circling round to have a look, that sort of thing, right? So all of that goes on a pink form, and then what happens is once you've got the pink forms done, they are put together with the yellow forms. It goes to a committee. Not a committee, I don't know what they call it. It's a group of people who match the two, and they just sit there. They're independent of anything that's gone on either side. They bring the two forms together and they tell the coroner whether there's a match or not. I think it's the coroner whereas the procedure is a bit hazy now, but they're the ones that decide if the yellow form and the pink form match up, and that is your person. And then that's when that information is released.
Do you know,
huge industry background.
One, what an amazing insight. So thank you very much. Two, that like, yes, in the time, it was probably kind of a bit of a horrible experience to go through, but also what an amazing experience to go through as well. But the whole time you were saying that, all I could think was, I'm just reading a book called Meltdown, and I'm just finishing a couple of pages with it. They were defining like tightly coupled systems and complexities from Perrow's work. And I was just thinking, well, if you've ever wanted a definition of tightly coupled system and complexity, literally the last 20 minutes of you talking, like from the stuff that happened on 7/7 and that work there, that is so, like, there's so much room for error there, isn't there? So much room for error. So this move to like a lot of emphasis on people being the solution in this, that must have just been second nature to you already, because you must have had to put so much onus on all of those officers in those moments being just on the ball, just really on the ball.
I mean, if you don't have empathy, then you've got no business doing that job, really. You've got to be able to recognise that they will act like it's just another job, but you know in full well that that's not just another job. And fortunately, the counselling and the aftercare that's come along more recently is very much part of what policing is about. Now, it's recognised that people will sometimes never recover from experiences like that. They'll go on, because of course you would. It's the police isn't a career usually, it's a calling, isn't it? Something. And you want to be a police officer, you want to do all the things that police officers do, and so those careers are given up unwillingly. So you have to be able to allow people to manage their way through some of these crises and post-traumatic stresses. It's a big job. No doubt.
Unbelievable. And from your point of view as a safety professional in that, which essentially your role is to try and reduce as much error as possible, stop something going wrong from a safety point of view, but I assume there are processes and systems in place to stop error happening from a contamination of evidence point of view. But so much of that stuff that you've spoke about is all on the person. Like, it must be interesting, like for example, I can't remember who I was talking to the other day, but they were given the example of the Hillsborough disaster, and he could never really explain to his dad was a police officer. I could never really explain to his dad, and if this person is listening, I apologize, I can't remember who you are, but he couldn't explain to his dad what he did really in his job in this new view, and trying to say, you know, we can't really blame the person and blah, blah, blah. And basically his dad always used to tell this story about he was a police officer at a football event or a big event or something like that. And the crowd was just unbelievable coming through. And his boss had said to him, don't open this gate. Whatever you do, don't open the gate. But this police officer was like, if I don't open this gate in the moment, was like, if I don't open this gate, someone's going to die. Like, I'm going to have to open the gate. Like, there's just too many people here. So he opened the gate and he got a rollicking. Like, he got a telling off. I told you not to open that gate, blah, blah, blah. And then when Hillsborough happened, and then in hindsight, his boss kind of came to him and said, do you know what? I shouldn't have told you off for that, because actually in hindsight, I can see that you did the right thing. Like, it wouldn't have been the Hillsborough disaster. It would have been the whatever disaster that you'd have caused, because you didn't open that gate. It caused in quotations. And he said, so is that kind of what you're talking about with your work stuff? And he was like, yes, dad, yeah, that's it. And I was like, so happy for him, what a lovely story. But also, like, that blame conversation that a lot of people really struggle with in safety, like, we can't blame the worker because, you know, there's a bigger context to that decision. In the police force, that must be a very interesting conversation as well, around like police office failure, and can we blame them when they're really under that much pressure, and so on and so forth.
They're the same fine margins, but they are they have to be made with rapidity. And those sort of dynamic decisions are the difference between life and death in a lot of cases. And I mean, we talk about the tube bombings or, you know, mass disasters, but, you know, daily this plays out for a lot of police officers. It's those snap decisions. And you can only do so much. I mean, dynamic risk assessment will only take you so far. It's reliant on the inject of information that you've had in the first place. It relies so heavily on the personality of the people concerned, how susceptible they are to red mist, how how blinkered, focused, tunnel visioned they are. So that all sorts of things come into play. And with hindsight being such a wonderful thing, you know, any of us can think we're doing the right thing in the right moment and be found wanting on the other side of it. It's usually not a life and death situation though. And it's usually not one that's going to appear in the Daily Mail or Evening Standard or News at 10. So they do an extremely difficult job in extremely difficult circumstances in some respects.
Yeah.
Some respects.
And probably even worse at the moment with the scrutiny that the police force are under around the world as well. It's just...
And they have to carry on regardless. You know, they've got to be evidence-based. You know, their whole career is about evidence. So whatever they're being criticised for at any one time, and don't get me wrong, you know, I'm as clear-eyed as anybody else about the police and its inherent failings in some areas.
Yeah.
But I don't think the police as an entity and the police as the individuals that make up the police force one by one are two wholly different things for me. And coming at it from that human angle, that person-centered angle, you've got to be able to separate the strategy and the tactics from the people who are actually carrying it out. I don't think, probably in my lifetime, there'll ever be a situation where police officers are routinely looked at as individuals. And I don't mean to be controversial in that. I just mean that it's too big a job, in a way, to base police strategy around the individuals who are carrying out those orders.
Yeah.
So I don't think in a normal workplace you maybe could, or within a normal team you maybe could, you know, apply some discretion according to an individual's makeup or mental state or, emotional state. I don't necessarily think you'd get that in some of the more operational disciplines of the police.
Well, I think it, I mean, without, we could go into probably a 2-hour conversation just about that, but I'm inclined to say that it's not controversial what you said, but I can understand why you kind of caveated that. But I think when we talk about it from a normal safety point of view, it's very similar to a way. Obviously, it's probably much more higher pressure in some of those situations in the police force, but it's very similar in a way that basically what we're saying is humans are fallible and they're heavily influenced by many, many, many things. And several of those things are created by us as the organization or the entity, which in your case is, or your previous case, is the police force as a business, which essentially is kind of what it is as an organization, which is influenced by budgets, by, you know, brand, by public perception, all of that stuff. And then all of the additional stuff that happens in that moment, like, interestingly, you mentioned red mist and stuff, which I never thought of, but in that moment of like a heated confrontation, how emotion can really kind of take over. And we, all of those things that influence us to make a decision that may be right, may be wrong. So I think I agree. I kind of get the point in that. I think we would probably fall short if we were to look at it on an individual per individual basis, because how can you when they're influenced by so many of those things?
Yeah. And it changes hour to hour. And however, you know, if you say, I think it was one of your previous guests would say, you don't know which person is coming to work necessarily. It's the person that had a row with their partner. It's the person that, suffered a bereavement or whatever. And those are just as true for police officers, but they are looked at differently. And you can see the dichotomy, can't you, between, you know, somebody that's got to be very strong on the outside. They've got to be quite authoritative. We're coming a bit full circle here. But on the inside, you know, they're going through it and their hair trigger is going to be different from one day to the next. So you've got a confrontational situation. They're also, of course, expected to be social workers these days, as you know. So dealing with a huge increase in the number of mental health patients that they see, or people who are suffering with mental ill health at the time of their contact with the police, they're expected to be social workers as well. And you can see if you're on a hair trigger anyway, you know, and maybe you're prone to red mist or maybe you're not, but you know, the two must be in huge conflict with each other at any given time. You've got you can't make way for the red mist. You can't punch somebody's lights out just because you're feeling, you know, a bit crap. Despite provocation, of which there is a lot.
I just won't say that. Oh, God, fascinating.
But they're not social workers, are they? They're authoritarian by their very nature. They're authoritarian. They're designed to be there to catch baddies and feel collars.
Well, to your point, it comes full circle, isn't it? They're meant to be that officer of that authoritarian position, not the empathetic person that's there to listen and understand. That's not their job.
But they're expected to do just that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny that, again, my cousin-in-law, if that is a thing, in that some of the conversations that we've had with her, similarly, the things that she really struggles with has been those things that actually she's asked to do that are not really within her role in those social worker type situations. Without saying too much, they're the things that really get to her, not because it's, oh, that's not my job, more that they're really hard things to do because she inherently is being quite empathetic to that position, but then is in a conflict with her role, which is interesting. And interesting, I think, maybe if some of the listeners, just to kind of tie this in a loop, it's really fascinating that we might think that we've come off base and we've not really spoke about the diversity stuff because we've ended up talking about your role. But I actually think we really have this whole time, if you think about it, because what's, and I might be wrong here, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what's really beautiful about this is that you had the two roles of the kind of enforcing officer and the consultancy role, which didn't fit your inherent female traits of kind of the more softer side of building relationships and stuff like that. I found the role in the Met, which inherently needed those female traits, those focusing on building a relationship with the officers and working out how to help them succeed in what they do and being more empathetic, because you needed to understand the challenges that they're going through. So whilst I think it may not felt like we've sat talking about diversity, actually diversity for me seems to be the thing that actually really helped you succeed. Obviously your skills and your talent did as well, but that's maybe what made the Met work so really well for you. Maybe, I don't know, I'm thinking out loud.
Possibly. And I think there's a bit of a blended approach to it, because you know, you do have to call a spade sometimes. There's no getting around it. But it just, it was a complete education, but something that I think, you know, I took away with me into my next role, which was all about creating a strategy around, you know, talking and collaborating and doing safety that was people-centered and engagement and forums and, you know, let's do safety with people, not to people. So you know, each stage, and I'm sure everybody goes through this, each stage taught me something a little bit more and gave me the confidence to take it that little bit further as well. So just suppressing the imposter syndrome a little bit more each time. So I can do it. I've learned this. I'm now going to put it into practice. And so that's how you progress, presumably. You learn and you adapt and you implement, don't you?
Well, we've been talking for quite a while. Hopefully it doesn't feel like that for you, but maybe it does.
It's not often again. No, these days I don't get a chance to revisit these sort of things very often. And it's quite nice to look back on it from a distance and say, well, yeah, that was a strange but exciting and very rewarding time.
Yeah, no, and well done and fair play to you. Like, what, and well done to anyone, you know, as a kind of shout out to all the people involved in that. you know, my respect goes out to you and every single one of them that worked on that, because that's just, like I say, I've got no words, so I'm not going to ruin it by trying to put words in there. But you have my respect. Well done. Do you want to kind of tie this up, maybe talk about the work you're doing now with the women in safety stuff, which I had every intention of talking a lot about, but damn you for having such an interesting career.
My apologies. Well, we can sort of tie it up, I suppose. So all the thread that's been running through this is around acknowledging that things are changing within the health and safety world, that some of these traits are becoming more prominent and more needed as we go on. And it's really just making sure that acknowledgement is pursued hotly by an increase in the number of people who can demonstrate those traits, either naturally or learnt. And this is not, you know, I chair an organisation which is rather grandly titled the Global Coalition of Women in Safety Networks, the idea of which is, you know, all over the world are these women in safety networks. It's clearly a thing. It's clearly what's needed. But they're all working, you know, relatively independently, doing their own thing. But bugger me, if they don't all have the same sort of ideology, the same objectives, the same thoughts and ideas about how to counteract some of the problems and the barriers. So what we decided, Louise and Malcolm Staves, who you've probably come across as well, who works at L'Oreal, and I had conflabs about how to bring this all together. And it's turned into this global coalition. And we had so much interest and enthusiasm for these networks to start coming together to work and share ideas together. And just to try and help each other out in a great big feminine traits way, enable each other to lift as we climb, as somebody once said, Viv Groskop, I think she wrote a book, didn't she, Lift As You Climb. So we can help not only some of the underrepresented groups within health and safety. It's not just about women. It's about diversity in general, inclusion in general. And some of the underrepresented networks, we can help get a voice, we can help them become more audible, but also help some of the individuals within those networks get opportunities to speak at conferences. You'll know as well as I do, you get the same faces, don't you, at conferences, the same invitees.
Yeah.
And what we would really like to do is hear some of the experiences of women and underrepresented groups who are maybe at the start of their career or maybe coming back into a career, maybe, you know, experiencing this career for the first time in their 40s or 50s. What is it like to be them? What is it that they need? What is it that they're experiencing? How can we help? What structures can we help with that will enable them to progress in their career and make a success out of themselves? So it's in its infancy. It's evolving all the time. But that first meeting that we had in January, we had a lady called Eldine Posniak, who's very well known in safety circles, but in particular Canada, North America. And she was in Arizona. It was 5 a.m. there, so she was having really strong coffee. And then it spanned that meeting spanned the globe. We had 16 people that went from Eldine at 5 a.m. to Trish Kerrin, who's over in, I'm going to say Melbourne or Sydney, I can't remember which, maybe even Brisbane. But she was drinking her last glass of wine at midnight. So, but and everybody was so enthusiastic about speaking to everybody else. And so it went right the way across through West Africa, through Europe, through India, Sri Lanka, right the way across. And that's where we're hoping to get to, is to not necessarily set common objectives, because these networks are individual. They do their own thing. And, you know, it varies depending on where they are in the world. But we can do peer-to-peer mentoring, for example. There's nothing to stop somebody in North America mentoring somebody in Sri Lanka and, you know, hearing from them about their networks and how they're getting on and setting themselves up. And, you know, more mature networks can learn from the fledgling ones, you know, just the same way as fledgling ones can learn from the mature ones. So it's all about bringing people together. It's all about, you know, amplifying voices, about offering opportunities. And I mean, Louise and I are huge advocates of this, so excited about it all, and all of the members are really excited as well to be able to do it. So that, so hopefully what we're doing is just nudging things along a little bit. And we've got grand ambitions, really. We start off with a bit of mentoring, peer-to-peer mentoring, and we end up with complete policy change in some of the developing nations, that they can start having health and safety legislation that actually means something.
Yeah,
so that's the ambition. Whether it outlives us both, probably, but that's where we're heading.
There's a Beyonce song in there somewhere, I'm sure, about women changing the world.
Not sung by me or danced by me.
I love that, and I think it's absolutely amazing. I think it's something we need more of as well. And I love that it's bringing those groups together, not necessarily saying, oh, we're just going to make a new group, another group. We're just going to say, well, hang on a minute. You've acknowledged there's groups there. How can we just help connect those groups together? And I think that is an example of the benefit of bringing diversity in. It's not about just ticking boxes. It, for me, it's that cognitive diversity of somebody in Africa, be it man, woman, young, old, whatever, has a different way of solving a problem to me and you over here in England, because we've had different experiences. And hearing, you know, that's kind of what we're trying to do at Project Miletum as well, is just give people a problem and just say, well, what's everyone's different ideas? And sometimes everyone's got the same idea. Sometimes someone's over here and someone's way over there. And it's just awesome to listen to groups of people coming together and collaboratively solving a problem. And when you make that group diverse, that's how you innovate. And I think that's what our profession needs more of.
Yeah, definitely. And you've also got those groups that can offer something out as well. So it's not just geographic networks. We've got some large organisations jumping on board as well. So we've, obviously L'Oreal are a founder member, if you like, and do an awful lot of, it's not so much sponsorship, but financial assistance to training courses and stuff. So Louise and Malcolm and a couple of others have been offering some of the young female leaders some safety leadership training, and Laura's have paid for that. So it's actual tangible things that we can bring out of it. And the more larger organizations we get on board, we've been speaking to some quite hefty organizations about bringing their women in safety, their women safety professionals into this network, or their diversity groups into this network, so that there's credibility there as well. Some of these organizations work in developing nations, so can you bring that influence to bear if you're part of our network? Let's feed some of that back into the nations in which you work, so that we could start to, again, just push things forward slightly. So there's a great big swell of enthusiasm for what it can achieve, even though you've got to start fairly small. The possibilities are huge, I think.
Yeah, outstanding. I love it. Outstanding. Looking forward to seeing what they can do. Thank you very much for your time, Anne.
You're welcome. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Okay, peeps, hope you enjoyed that episode of our diversity mini-series. Remember, if you want a feedback, then please, we welcome it. If you want to share comments, if you want to comment on the post or whatever it is, YouTube video, whatever it is you want to do, we really appreciate your feedback. And we really, really want you to help us all learn, so we can learn together. But ultimately, let's do it from a nice, respectful and empathetic way, and understand that some people are not as mature on the journey as others. Don't forget to check out Paradigm Human Performance HSE subscription service. You can get hold of them at the email address and phone number below. And if you want to go check out the Learning Organization webinar, or you just want to check out Paradigm some more, go to the website in the description below. Thank you very much for partnering with us, Paradigm Human Performance. We absolutely love what you're doing. I think you're an outstanding company, an outstanding bunch of people. If you're keen to understand more of what I'm doing, you can check me out. That's a really bad way to say that. You can follow me on LinkedIn. I'm probably the most active on LinkedIn. I'm trying to improve my Twitter recently, even though Twitter makes me feel really uncomfortable. So you can follow me on Twitter as well. And don't forget to follow Rebranding Safety as well. We're on LinkedIn. That's probably where we're most strong as well. We've also got Facebook and Twitter as well. So make sure you check us out on all of those. All the links in the description below. If you want to come check out what we're doing at Project Miletum, also the link for that is in the description below. But otherwise, I shall catch you next week. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.